Welcome to the Analytics Power Hour. Analytics topics covered conversationally and sometimes with explicit language. Here are your hosts, Mo, Michael, and Tim.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. It's the Analytics Power Hour, and this is episode 224. Let me start with a story. I was riding back to the office from one of the first meetings I'd ever had with an executive audience. It was really early in my career. My coworker, Michael Moores, turned to me and said, "Hey, you did a good job today, but here's some feedback for you. Always know your audience." At first, I really didn't understand that, and he explained that basically most of the people in that room had cared about what I had to say, but they didn't understand all the minutiae in the way I had explained it. And I would get a lot more traction if I leveled my language to their understanding or their level. And so that was, in my mind, one of my first lessons in building communication skills. And it stuck with me throughout my career. And I think as data and analytics professionals, we can sometimes leave these kinds of skills for others without thinking about how important they might be to our success. So we wanted to talk about it. Analyst communication skills. Hey, Mo, what do you think about it?
Oh, I'm just, I feel like we talk about communication so often, but it's at the core of what we do. And I'm really excited to get stuck into it.
I think so too. And I'm excited to talk about it with you. And Tim, this one, I think, yes, the quintessential analyst. I don't know if you know how great your communication skills are, but do you think about that stuff?
I open every time I'm presenting to stakeholders with kind of like a ggplot tip from R. Like that's kind of my go-to. It doesn't matter who the audience, I figure like tell them how to throw something into an aesthetic in a ggplot and they're loving it, eating out of my hand. Perfect for the executive audience.
That's right. Hey.
Whatever works.
Whatever works. Well, since we're podcast hosts, we didn't need a guest to talk about communication, so we're going to fly solo because we're all excellent communicators. No, but I think to sort of get the conversation flowing, sort of when you think about that, like how do you think about communication skills, like in terms of like the tool set of an analyst, like in your mind? Let's talk about that just as a starting point.
I mean, Mo, you have a team, so I feel like that's where you – I really want to hear what you think because you've got – I assume you have the like the poor communicators and the great communicators somewhere on a spectrum, which means you've – I assume you've got – you see it.
It's definitely on a spectrum, and it's hands down the most difficult thing to coach. And particularly as people get more senior – if they're not good at this skill, it's actually even more difficult to coach them on it because you kind of like when someone's a junior, right? Like you can shadow them in meetings and give them like observed feedback through like their interactions with their stakeholders or whatever. And like they're learning, they're quite receptive to feedback. I think as people get more senior, it's harder because as their manager, you don't want to be like, I'm going to shadow you to all your meetings. And like, but it's honestly like sometimes that's how you can, like, you have to see someone communicating to actually help them improve. And so it just gets really tricky the more senior someone gets in terms of like refining that skill set. Like, we do scenario stuff, I do with some of the senior team members, but it's not the same as observing someone in the moment and how they're explaining something or taking a stakeholder through something.
What do you mean by the scenario? Like, you actually
like role scenarios. Play?
Like role play is it that are artificial or kind of like as a way to prep for an important?
Both. So typically if like someone's presenting to a senior audience and especially like if it's one of their first times, even if they are a senior team member, I would do prep sessions where they are like, I'm like, take me through your deck, talk like I'm your audience, practice on me. But we also sometimes retrospectively will go through and be like, okay, this conversation didn't go well. Like, tell me about it. Who was in the room? What happened? What was their body language? Like, how did things start? How was your like mood when you were starting the meeting as well? And we'll kind of, I guess, do a retro on it and then try and ask questions to get them to identify themselves on what they could improve. But it's hard, right? Because then you're also relying on their memory and their interpretation of what happened, which is very different to if you're sitting in the room as kind of like a neutral observer. And yeah, the summary is it's really freaking hard. It's really hard to coach.
But it does seem like just awareness of it. I mean, do you talk to your team in a group or an individual setting of like, look, communication is a real part of the job. Like, where let's talk about not the results, not the analysis that we did, or not what we were reviewing, but let's just focus on how we framed it and how we communicated it.
Yeah, and I also think the biggest or the most helpful thing for people is evidence, right? So one of the things, especially with the senior team members, that we focus a lot on is like when we have communicated something really well, they know, like the result is normally very positive or it's well received or accepted or like the recommendation is listened to. And so then that's something we'll discuss as well, because you're like, if this has been well received because we've done a good job of communicating it, like we discuss it and basically that helps them collect evidence that working on communication skills is worthwhile. It's still fucking hard though. Like I feel like I'm talking like I have all the answers, and it's so not true, because it's still, I would say, the thing I spend most of my energy on myself personally, but also in terms of getting everyone in the team there.
And before we get too far along, Tim, I'd like to hear your answer to this as well, in terms of sort of like how you approach it or how you think about it. Because I'm just curious, like you may have a slightly different take and that might hit a whole different segment of our listenership.
Well, I guess I struggle. I mean, I think there's the mechanical aspects of communication, which are data visualization, presentation development, data storytelling. And I say that's mechanical. It's not formulaic, but there's all the collateral that you're using in the communication. And then there's the actual delivery. And I struggle with like the person. Like, I don't know how much is me. Like, I have high anxiety equivalent to the stakes of whatever the discussion is. Once I get into it, I tend to relax more quickly than I would have expected. You guys know I will pop off the random analogy or the thinking out loud. I will inject humor in most situations, but I also watch people but I also still take it seriously. So I struggle with how much of the communication is just trying to be thoughtful and present and let your personality be part of it. You know, it's like you can't tell people like, oh, you need to be funnier. Like that ain't going to work. And you're gonna have somebody, all this, you know, somebody, we said the spectrum. I mean, there are people who are on the autism spectrum, and
it's like saying, be less nervous.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's not going to work that way. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's interesting. Cause I think similarly, like a lot of the things you just described, Tim, are all sort of what I would like call tactics, like using humor or, you know, injecting different things or analogies. They're all like different ways of like maneuvering, basically. So that's sort of what you just described in my head. And that's the thing I think over the years, what I've come to embrace is like, I feel like a lot of times we think of like, especially like verbal communication, which maybe a lot of this show will be about more so than other. We've covered other communication topics like presentation and visual presentation more, but I think we sometimes think in our minds that that's sort of like we have a fixed level of it and we don't necessarily think of it as changeable, but it's actually like is full of tactics and strategies you can leverage. And so like my first experience with that was when, and my story at the beginning of what, like, that's why it stuck with me was like, oh, I can do something about this. I can think about who's in the room.
Do you remember the specifics of kind of where you went wrong on that? I mean,
I went way in depth on some kind of web trends, tracking minutia, you know, because this was way, way back
when. Sounds like a barrel of laughs.
Web trends. Yeah. Yeah, it was. I was way deep in, like, you know.
So our aggregate table, the reporting table limit was only 1,000.
Exactly. So it's something like
a cardinality issue.
So you have two tags that form a scenario in web trends: the wt.si underscore n and the wt.si underscore. So that kind of stuff was what the executive audience was not super, like, down to hear about, right? And so, like, that was what I was learning about. But as you go through life, not only are you learning sort of, like, how much information should I put out there in this moment based on who's there, but also how do I sell my idea in? I remember when I was younger, and I still have this to this day, like, I don't particularly enjoy picking up the phone and calling people. I don't actually like talking to people I don't know. It's a weird thing. Like, I'm actually an introvert, and a lot of people think I'm not, but I actually am. And so, like, you learn these skills. You learn, and so you get more comfortable because you learn those skills. And so when you were answering, Tim, that was sort of what I was hearing, was like, I think you've built up a set of skills that you've used, and you're a great analyst, so you're watching, okay, hey, that kind of helped alleviate the tension when I said something funny and made everybody, like, relax a little bit. I'm going to use that again. I'm going to try to figure out how that's going to incorporate into as I discuss and describe things with people. Because at the end of the day, and Mo, I think you kind of brought this front forward first, was when we present an analysis or something like that we've discovered, an insight, we're usually talking about changing or modifying something that's happening. And so that's a very risky place to be. We're in a place where the winds could shift on us at any moment. Someone could come flying in and be like, well, you haven't thought about X, Y, or Z. And suddenly, like, our whole analysis is dashed and our credibility to that meeting is thrown out the window. And it can be really devastating for a junior analyst to sort of be put in a position where they're dealing with those things. But that's where I think thinking about it in terms of, like, there's skills I can learn and there's tactics I can use, then that sort of puts you in a place of, like, okay, well, today I might not feel really strong, but I can actually develop a set of skills. And maybe I'm not going to be, I don't know, who's the most amazing communicator you can think of? Maybe, like, President Obama or something, right? Oh, just an amazing communicator. Yes. And, okay, I'm never going to be as good as him, but for me, I can develop more and more, right? Or something like that, right? So that's kind of the way I think about it. All right, it's time to step away from the show for a quick word about Pivot Pro. Tim, tell us about it.
Well, Pivot Pro is easy to implement, easy to use, and reminiscent of Google's Universal Analytics in a lot of ways.
I love that it's got basic data views for less technical users, but it keeps advanced features like segmentation, custom reporting, and calculated metrics for power users.
We're running Pivot Pro's free plan on the podcast website, but they also have a paid plan that adds scale and some additional features.
That's right. So head over to pivot.pro and check them out for yourself. Get started with their free plan. That's pivot.pro. All right, let's get back to the show.
Can we combine? I want to put Michael on the spot with the observing somebody who's senior who may not be super receptive to feedback. And I'm pretty sure this example, we have alluded to it in the past, but there's kind of a, Michael and I will both take to the end of our careers when we were working together, one meeting with the CMO at a client that I lost him. Like, it was going horribly. To the point that Well, the client was getting pretty frustrated to the point that he basically got up to leave the room. He was like, I'm done. And it was, I think my assessment would be, well, this was kind of, there were unreasonable requests. He was trying to look at things that weren't going to get him where he needed to go. And we had not been able to steer him to, like, that's not productive. And he was getting prescriptive and I had done what he wanted and it wasn't giving results. And I'm like, yeah, that's kind of what we thought. And he was getting up to leave. And Michael, like, actually grabbed him, which I think was largely, this was like from an emotional intelligence and listening and understanding what was happening. I mean, I was probably getting a little bit limbic, and Michael managed to grab him and pivot the conversation and then have a discussion with him. So I don't know if you can think through, that was definitely a communication failure on my part. You were observing me. It did fail and you managed to recover. All of it was kind of dying. I mean, he wasn't going to lose the client. The guy would have stormed off and we would have been fine later. But what was your take on what went wrong?
So I can't remember so much about that specific situation, except whenever I'm in a room like that, where that kind of conversation is happening, and even when I'm talking to a group of people, I'm extremely mindful of the cues that people are giving off. Like I'm watching them in a lot to see like how engaged are they with what I'm talking about. Cause that's the whole thing in a meeting where the most senior person picks up their phone and starts fiddling with it while you're talking. It's pretty impolite, frankly, of that person to do that. But it's also an excellent cue to you to know, okay, I've lost the most senior person in the room. If I want them back, what do I need to do? And so that is sort of where we were in that conversation, Tim, was like I had observed sort of like, okay, a growing disconnect. And I kind of knew from some of the questions that were coming his way, I was interpreting them slightly differently, I think because I'm dumber than you, Tim, so I was more on his wavelength. So I was interpreting them a little differently, and so I think I had a different way of describing it, and that was, in that particular situation, what turned out to be the nice synergy we had between us. Was basically, I was just sort of like, oh, I think if I explained it this way, it might click with them a little better.
Do you know what's really funny? Exactly what you just explained is a dynamic I have with someone in my team where he'll be like, oh, Mo, like you explained that really well to stakeholder X, Y, or Z. And I'll be like, I literally took the analogy that you had or the explanation you had. And because you're way smarter than me, like you were able to explain it to me, but then I'm able to, let's go with simplify it a little further for a stakeholder that doesn't have our background.
And if we didn't want to use false humility, Mo, what we would say is basically empathy is the driver of that for us, right? So basically your empathy is helping you understand what that person needs, and then you communicate effectively with them because you are seeing the world through their eyes a little bit more.
I definitely will not concede this whole smarter bullshit, but it's actually funny because I was saying, oh, so what you're saying is that both of you were listening better, which I think is actually a miss. It's not, because I think empathy's the better. Well, I mean, I think there is some listening involved, but
I think Helms is a better listener. I'm not a great listener, she says, but I think, interrupts.
But I think listening and then empathizing, right? And this is something I learned through one of my son's therapists, like the friend. I think I've said it on here before, like the fighting the tendency to kind of judge where they are. It's like empathy is super, super important. Everyone is doing the best they can in the moment. So if they're not understanding what you're saying, don't just say more. Don't assume that they're stupid, or don't assume that they're out to get you. It is much, much more productive to take a breath. I guess that's the other thing, is to actually slow down. There's a tendency to say, no, let me give you more, more, more. Let me explain the other minutiae of the web trends, as opposed to saying, wait a minute, time out, let's reset. And if I can say, I am not communicating this well, help me. I mean, whether this is explicitly or just what's going on in your head, I need to figure out more where you are. Like,
Do you know the
act of listening. Yeah.
Do you know my thing at the moment is analogies? Like, and I don't know why, but I would say the last kind of like 18 months where we've had lots of success is where we've come up with a really relatable analogy for something that we're trying to get our stakeholders to understand, or something that we're trying to explain, that because once they get that, they can use that as a jumping point to understand the more technical thing that you're discussing. And I swear, like I'm generally, like me and the leads in marketing data are like, okay, what's the analogy we need for this particular concept we're about to introduce, or this particular methodology that we need senior leadership to get behind? And I feel like there's been a step change where I don't think I focus so much on analogies as I probably have in the last 18 months.
I think I finally realized in the last few years, because people would call out, because I tend to spontaneously do analogies, and for whatever reason, like they more often than not, they actually hold up. Like, you have to be careful. But that's also a way to get humor in, right? Like if you start, like if it, it becomes relatable, it can be humor. It can point out some of the, if it's a good analogy, it can point out like things that would be ludicrous, like next steps to do. I've been doing some writing and I've got a whole like weight loss analogy. Like, well, this would be like, you know, silly. I mean, I find they when they come spontaneously, sometimes they're sillier and more fun and they lighten the room or lighten the tone, and that can get people. But I also definitely think using them, but they can also kind of fail. Like when somebody tries to push it, if as an analyst, you say, I'm going to use this analogy, and then you get oversold on it and try to push it too hard, and all of a sudden it feels
when it doesn't.
Forced.
Yeah, yeah.
But 1,000% agree. And that's also, I think, just from a retention, right? That analogies go into storytelling, which go into memory and sustaining and giving us. There's a lot of sort of brain science that says that's going to help with retention of the idea.
Well, the really nice thing as well about an analogy is like there is normally that storytelling component, but then there's normally a way to represent it visually or something. So you can normally appeal to lots of different communication styles using the same thing, but just like tweaking it slightly based on someone's personal preferences.
And then you've really hooked if the audience says, well, what if their question, if they frame it in terms of like pushing the analogy, and it doesn't matter whether it holds up or not, because it shows that they're trying to fit. And a lot of times it actually does hold up and you're like, oh yeah, the analogy actually holds with that thing. I mean, there's another Rusty Raymer who I think we've had him on the podcast, but it's funny, even secondhand, I've heard of a sinking ship, a Titanic analogy that he's used, that like that's like the level of staying power that, and I actually don't know the specifics of the situation, but it's like, well, that shows the power. And I don't know that he was actually thinking about it ahead of time. He just used it and said, it's like the boat is sinking and we're bringing on water. And so our solution is let's go put another hole in the boat to let the water out. You know, like that's not helpful. And I don't really know the context of it, but you're like, well, yep, that gives somebody imagery. But that starts to blend into, I mean, that's Michael, in your terms, that's a tactic. And I think that's a storytelling tactic, but man, it's really useful. And it does seem like there are people who are really good. I mean, you really get the double whammy if it's an analogy that is either really relatable to you as a person, you know, if I used a on the audience, or it's relatable to the audience. Like
if I know anything about the people in the room, I will try to craft my analogies around their interests and points of things that they are fascinated by, right? Because it makes more connectivity, it makes it easier.
Again, a fine line. Like if it's, you know, somebody's like an avid golfer and you're not an avid golfer and you try to use an analogy and it's like it turns out to be a shitty analogy because you don't understand.
But that's where you use humor, right? You know, and be like, well, I'm not a great golfer like so and so. Because that's the other thing in communicating things is it's, you can, what's the right way to say it? Like the way I learned was called verbal judo. But it's basically.
I'm intrigued.
What it means is sort of like you, whenever you're in a situation that has potential conflict in it, how do you kind of disarm people before they become a problem? And so like there's these tactics, little things you can do. Like I always like to use the one where I make it their idea. And so you'll be like, well, so-and-so had this great idea to analyze this, this, or this. And so we did that. And so now that person who might be an objector is now kind of like, well, I can't really go against my own idea now.
Oh, shit. I need to practice that. And
so, or you say something like, you know, you take something they said and then you build on it as if their thing was the first part of the thing you're going to say, which then makes them a part owner.
Oh, and that is so good. You know, when you're like, I need to write that down. And then I feel like when it comes to this tactic stuff, you have to actually you have to make a conscious effort to try them out.
Well, I think the thing you said early on, Mo, where you do the role playing piece of it, as smarmy and weird as that might feel in the moment, that's a perfect place to like actually pick tactics, leverage them, and then feed them back to each other and say like, okay, I loved how you did this, right? So basically someone comes in with an objection, you'd be like, well, that's a great point. And, you know, and as you have often said, and then you give, you bring in something they say or do and make it sound smart, then they kind of are like, oh, they're giving me a compliment or they're on my side. So I can't now like be opposed to them necessarily. So there's little things like that you can do. And so you just have to learn like little skills like that. And it's not always, like at this point in my life, I consciously do some of those things. But I think the first times I ever did it, it was sort of like an accident. And I was just sort of like, again, I don't think I'm like everybody else in that I will replay conversations in my head for days.
Me too.
Especially the ones that I don't think I did very well in. And I'll be thinking about, and it goes back to like the whole, like when you're a kid schoolyard thing and that 2 days later you come back with that, you come up with a cool comeback. You're like, oh, what I should have said was, you know, or whatever. Like I was never good at those.
Me either.
But that's the thing is you can start to build up a skill set around those. And again, that's more for dealing with like oppositional moments in communication.
Okay. But Helms, one of the things that I've been asked a bit about previously was to do with like, I don't know, when someone says like shitty comments to you in the workplace that you're not comfortable with or whatever. And like that schoolyard explanation of not having the comeback right then, like that is totally me. And what I've learned to accept is that it's okay in that moment, because I'm not always like the on the spot person. And this is true of if someone says something inappropriate or it's just a comment in a meeting that you're thinking about days later that you're like, I could have handled that better. With Harry now, we have do-overs. And sometimes I say to him, like, I don't like how I just did that. Can we have a do-over? And adults can do the same. Like, you can go back to your stakeholder and be like, hey, I was thinking about that meeting we had 2 days ago. I didn't like how I handled X, Y, and Z. Here's what I've been thinking. And I actually think there is, like, a lot of self-forgiveness in that. In, like, instead of, like, beating yourself up about not handling it perfectly that moment of, like, okay, I can go back and, like, reframe something or have another try. Anyway, that's...
It also helps me with my whole, like, I'm pretty petty. So whenever I do that to people on purpose, I really like it. Because it's a socially acceptable way of handling a difficult situation without actually confronting someone or having to get in there. It's sort of like, and that's why I call it verbal judo, because it's sort of using their own momentum against them a little bit.
Well, anyways, yeah. But I think that's, I mean, there's sort of two, there's the manipulative way to do it. Like I've learned the skill to sort of take it and then there's, but I think parallel with that is it actually does force you to recognize they actually did have a good point. This was the source. This was the and I think defensiveness is terrible. I will say the coming up and doing a do-over, just literally last weekend I was at a big family reunion and I've got a second cousin who is funny, she lived in Sydney, she was in Manly, and I visited her the couple of times I was there. Then she moved to Hong Kong, so she was down the road from Josh. Now she's in Hawaii. Her husband couldn't make it for the trip, but her husband has worked at the trade desk for years, and I see her every 4 or 5 years. And somehow at this family reunion, AI came up and she was like, oh, Dave, and her husband wasn't able to come. Great guy. And she's like, Dave's doing all sorts of like cool stuff with AI. And she was like, I know Tim. You think he's evil. You think the media is evil. You think the trade desk is evil, which is true. And I kind of ran with it. So we had like a 2 minute interaction. And I just basically ripped this guy's career. I felt horrible about it. Like I literally like tracked her down the next day at the next thing. I was like, oh, Kat, like I am like, that was not. She was like, you're fine. I was like, I don't want my interaction to be like slamming your husband's. But I replayed that like that. I woke up kind of early in the morning and I was like, why? Like what, to what end were you taking your little hobby horse that fine on your little analytics podcast? You can rip these organizations, but you know, maybe not the right place with somebody you really like and her husband who you really like, who's not even there to defend himself.
That is self-awareness. I think that where I really struggle is when, say, there is a conversation like that doesn't go particularly well and the data person like doesn't get that maybe they're part of the problem or like they need to improve. And it's kind of like, oh, well, our stakeholders are really tough or their expectations are unreasonable or they're asking X, Y, and Z and it's stupid. That's my like like that one really gets up me because I'm like,
yeah,
they have less information than you about this topic. Like, if they're asking for the wrong things and it's your job to help them try and understand what the right things to ask for are. But yeah, I guess I want to steer the conversation a little bit towards around like when things aren't going well or when people don't have this skill set nailed down. And like you said, Helbs, it's always a continuum and people can always improve no matter how great you think you are. I think there are lots of people that think they're good at it and they're not. And I mean, that could be us.
No, I would say I probably come out of situations about 30 to 40% of the time satisfied with how I communicated. Most of the time, I still think I don't like it. So it's like, trust me, the imposter syndrome is hanging out real strong. but you're right. So like, again, this goes back to sort of like, if you don't think you have anything to learn, then you probably don't. And you can't learn new things, and there's going to be your upside is inhibited as a result of that.
Wait, but no, if you think you don't have anything more to learn, then you are you definitely have less.
Well, you do, but in your mind that you don't, right? So it's sort of like
you're not open to
the
it.
The idea of competence that you don't have, sort of the Dunning-Kruger.
So basically, the listeners who most would benefit from this podcast already like skipped it.
This is okay. So this is what my sister says to me whenever I'm concerned about like a kid thing, like, I don't know, let's say it's sleep. And she's like, if you're thinking about it and reading about it and trying to come up with a game plan because you're worried about it, then you actually don't need to worry about it because you already care. Right. And it's like the people who are seeking out information to improve their communication skill or listening to the podcast about it are probably the ones that are pretty good at it already. Whereas the ones that.
Well, they're on their way. Like, I think, you know, our listeners self-select, right? So people who don't.
Everyone self-selects.
But I'm saying like people who don't need to learn new things don't need to listen to this podcast. So they probably don't.
True.
So there you go.
But okay. I've got to ask. It's been kind of – this always happens when we're doing an episode and I'm like, oh, I want to try this thing with my team. And then I've got a few Tims in my team and I'm like, is there going to be
I'm so sorry.
A revolt around this because everyone's like, Mo, for fuck's sake, stop experimenting on us and give us a fucking break. So like we talked about role playing. Like is it worth a team – like we do technical training sessions and we have training sessions where we share code and like there's a whole process around like peer reviews and yada, yada, yada to hone your programming skills. Is there like, I guess what I'm trying to say is as a people manager, should we put more emphasis into, I guess, a curriculum for this and potentially getting your team into a room and being like, right, these are the scenarios that we're going to role play that often come up with our stakeholders. Here is a bunch of tactics that we can use and test them out. Let's all have a go at trying out these different tactics. Or would they kill me?
Do you train or educate on visual data presentation? Like
totally.
Okay. So then how is that any different than verbal communication or nonverbal communication?
I totally agree. I think that one, when it comes to like making time for this stuff, it often gets put at the bottom of the list. Like I'll be like, I should do this. And in like a year's time, we'll be talking about it again. And I'll be like, I really should have done that. I also think it's like you have people in the team that are just kind of like, oh, this isn't important. Or like, I'm already good at this. I roll. I'm not going to participate. Well, and I think that's hard.
I feel like the big turning point for me on this stuff was there. I don't know. Does Radiolab still exist, Tim?
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't. Robert Krulwich is retired, but.
Okay. But there was this Radiolab I listened to a long time ago about decision making and basically how they had tested people who like lost their connection between their two halves of their brain, the corpus callosum, and they had asked them to choose a brand of toothpaste in an American supermarket. And so like there's 40 different brands and they thought that because now the person had no emotion attached to their decision making, the logic would allow them to quickly select the toothpaste that they wanted to buy. And the opposite was true. They were completely unable to make a choice. And so the research sort of showed that emotion plays this extremely significant role in decision making. And so that and like the book Switch by Chip and Dan Heath I was reading that book around the same time, and I think that for me was like this major turning point, inflection point in my career of realizing, oh my gosh, like all of the data and logic and information that I'm able to communicate means absolutely nothing if there's not an emotional connection to what I'm talking about and what I'm recommending that we do. And it sort of turned on a big light for me because, you know, like I say Tim's the quintessential analyst, and I do mean that, but I always joke, and it's sort of true, like I'm not the strongest statistician or analyst or math person. I think I'm decent, but I'm not great like some of the people I've met in my career. But that was the way that I realized I could contribute to great analysis, was I could be the connector of the people between the idea and the statistics and the logic and the emotion to make the decision to move forward. And
the data translator, if you will.
Well, a lot of people have tried to come up with words for it, and none of them have been sufficient for Tim up to this point. But yes, in a way, that was the big moment for me. And I don't know if you can create that moment for other people, but that is, there's science behind this. There's absolute science behind this.
I think there are two things. And Michael, there's one, recognizing that it is important. And I think about the way that when I do training or coaching on even data visualization, I always start with, and actually Michelle and I kind of had a shared thing. Like, let's explain a little bit of the neuroscience behind how memory works and how decision-making works. This is definitely locking me into what my last call is going to be now based on this discussion. So that's part of it, is the intellectual, like this does. And I think the Heath brothers, Nancy Duarte, Leah Pika, there is an abundance, and I'm sure there is the perfect TED talk that is okay, let's communicate to the team that this shit really does matter.
Like Simon Sinek?
Sure.
Before he got super popular, yes.
And then there's the second part, which is, okay, how do we get better? The role playing, or the how do we go about it? To me, as you were heading down that, if I had a team and was doing it, it almost feels like it's similar to this discussion. Like, well, we could all sit in a room and make this workshop. Let's talk about whether it's everybody shares one thing they think they do well, or a tip, or something they've seen somebody else. Like, just to force the brain to kick into the analytical side of, like, what have you seen John do that you think is really effective from a purely communicating point? Like, to me, that's where getting a team to collaborate on coming up with what those tactics are. It shows that everyone has different strengths. It shows that you can always be improving. Like, you know, the analogy thing comes up. Well, sure, maybe three people in the room, maybe no one has the light bulb clicked other than you, Mo, that like, holy crap, we're starting to use analogies, and that really seems to be working. Like, to me, like, baking that into the culture, this is all theoretical, to say that's going to be part of our every other team meeting we have. We're going to spend 10 minutes coming up with what we've seen that was effective communication, what we've done that seemed like it was really effective, or what really didn't work and we don't understand why, or something like it feels like something that needs to be baked in as a you're going to constantly be getting better. But if you haven't gotten over that first hurdle where Michael was like, wait, you weren't getting over the hurdle, but I think...
Yeah, like if someone doesn't think it's important.
If they don't think it's important, then all that other stuff is wasted. They're not going to absorb it. They'll be the jackasses saying, what do you mean? The data speaks for itself. Why does it have to be clearly communicated? And then I get violent.
Okay, we've got to revisit a comment from our last episode, because... I was going to, like, literally after Helms did the intro, I was going to go straight to this because I'm so dying to talk about it, and we didn't really get enough. It's actually part of what inspired this particular topic. But Dr. Janet Basterman was talking about, like, technical things, and I was kind of asking whether it's a skill you have to develop over time, whether you get better at learning to explain things. And one of the things she said was that she's finding more junior people are actually really good or better at explaining things. And I don't know if it's like to do with the newness or more recent experience having learned about a particular topic. But the reason I've been thinking about it so much is that as soon as she said it, I was like, oh shit, yeah. Like, I've got some junior people on my team that are some of the best communicators I've ever seen. Like, best presenters, communicators can explain these so technical, like, technical concepts that I would struggle to explain. And I have seen them own a meeting with everyone smiling and nodding and understanding exactly what they're talking about and asking really thoughtful questions. And it's made me really reflect on, is this to do with like the newness or the learning, or is this like young people are actually getting taught this better through their schooling? And that's like a, I don't know.
So we should be using TikTok.
I walked away, and this is unfair because, Michael, you wound up not being able to, based on the magic of timing, you haven't heard that episode, but it was because I heard it as, if they are motivated, if they have only recently had a light bulb go on for themselves, then they're going to have more empathy for the audience because that was them just a week ago. And I think the concern is, oh crap, are we, one, we need to really acknowledge and reward them and call that out and say, you are going to, this is going to be a skill you have to retain as you get more advanced in your career, because the curse of knowledge is a real thing. And this thing that you're explained just yesterday and did a phenomenal job, it's going to feel obvious and old and easy to you in 3 years. And you are going to forget that is still going to be new information to people that you're interacting with. And let's focus on how you explained it. Let's, like, I don't know. I feel like that, I think we're missing on that, on saying, if you do something well, you've got to be able to lock in this moment right now and be able to recall that in 3 years or 5 years. You have to be able to remember when you only barely newly understood that concept and put yourself in that place, which goes back to, Michael, the empathy. Because you're moving ahead, but a lot of times the new stakeholders you're working with are in the same spot, and you're going to be farther away from them with your knowledge in the future. And that's on you to close that gap, not on them just based on where they are.
Yeah, keeping that same empathy even though it's 1,000th time you've explained it, sort of.
Yeah, it's funny because I feel like I've done a good job maybe of communicating to that person like, oh, hey, that was phenomenal. The way you explained that really hit home, yada, 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 like giving them, even if there are a couple of constructive points. But it's that actually having that conversation with them of like, it's going to get harder to explain this when you're explaining it for the 1,000th time. And it's going to get harder to explain it as you learn more about it and you understand more about it. And like calling out that you need to remember this and how you did it so that you don't, I guess, get too far away from that empathy.
That's really good.
But I do think that's the part of the challenge of communication in the analytics world is that the data never gets simpler. Like none of us have said, oh man, I'm so glad that I'm working with the environment that I am now, because the data is so much less complex and the operating environment is so easier. So like as the world gets more complicated and the data gets more complex and the tools get more involved, the human capacity to understand a concept isn't really moving that quickly. So I feel like the gap, explaining how web analytics worked when it was a log file analysis, was like, you could do it. You know, that's like a 5-minute conversation. Well, that, if you jump to, in the digital analytics world, to server-side tracking and first-party cookies, like the what's going on under the hood is wildly more complex, but the stakeholders, I mean, they're going to get more sophisticated. They're going to be more steeped in some of the mechanics of that, but they're not moving along. So it becomes a bigger communication challenge to get to the essence of what they need to understand in a way that's kind of clear. I think it's it's just going to grow as a, it's going to continue to increase as a challenge. When we talk about generative AI, when we talk about machine learning, when we talk about some of the statistics stuff, I didn't need to talk about, I didn't need to understand statistics at all when I started in the analytics world. I was just, you know, crunching data. And yeah, the communication is getting more challenging, not less.
All right. Well, we're getting very close to the end, but there's one little additional thing I want us to cover. Tim, you had it in the notes around what I'll call venue for a conversation, because I think this is really undervalued as well, which is sort of like we've been talking a lot about like how you talk in meetings, but a lot of times communication is done one-on-one via email, via Slack or Microsoft Teams. And a lot of times people don't use these tools super well or to their advantage. I don't know if you had thoughts about that, Tim. It was, you had that in the notes, but I thought it was something I thought would be very worthwhile to bring up in this episode.
I mean, I am terrible about the going too far, especially because I can type quickly enough, and it's like I will go through multi-threaded back and forth when, like, you know, a phone call, or you know what, let me grab 30 minutes. Let's actually have this as a real dialogue. I mean, as we were prepping for this, I wound up turning up a post that was basically like six times you should just make a phone call. Like, if you need to apologize, if you want to apologize, if you think there are going to be a lot of questions, then don't do it through an email. If it's something complicated, then, I mean, a phone call or a meeting. If you've taken too long to respond and you need to probably eat a little apology, humble pie. If you need to talk about something personal, so there's when it's really important. So I think picking the venue, and I think as analysts, we have a tendency to want to, oh, let me put the deck together and then present it and then walk away, or let me send the email with the data and be done. And I think there's a tendency just from a time pressure to want to move on to the next task, and the one-on-one interaction, or I'm going to present it and I know it's going to be awkward for this one person. We'll find the time to talk to that person ahead of time so that they're not being blindsided. All of that stuff takes time, and all of it can be scary because you have less control in a conversation. And as somebody who's definitely has been in conversations where he's lost his shit and then agonizes about it later, that's scary, but it's often the best medium. Man, that's me sounding preachy.
No, but I really like it. And especially because a lot of people are remote. So like the chances for like one-to-one or informal or hallway conversations are limited. Like that changes things and how you got to communicate. And I always try to remember this message, like email doesn't have tone. So how the person reads it, it applies the tone that they're going to take from it. So basically it's like, however, if they're feeling like shit that day and they're down on themselves, your email, while trying to be super neutral and not bad at all, is going to come across to them as super over the top and accusatory, and it's going to be awful. And sort of like, okay, well then maybe I can pick up the phone and have the conversation in person. Or one tool I think sometimes gets overused, but it's super helpful sometimes, is like tools like Loom, where you make a little video explaining what is going on. And that a little 4 or 5 minute video sometimes will stop a whole email thread from happening. Right. So like
Slack Zoom is hands down my favorite Slack feature. Like a person
jump into
who,
a quick one-on-one.
Yeah. Like honestly, when a thread starts going in Slack, I actually go the opposite, and I like, it's almost like my brain is like, I can't digest you. And I'm like, can we just, I will pick up the phone and call you. I will Zoom with you, but like, you've got to talk me through it, because it's like, it just goes straight over my head as soon as it gets too slacky.
I need to look into Loom, because I've had cases where I've done a YouTube when I'm, you know, inside a company, so I can make it private, and I'm like, it's still short. I need you to see a couple visuals and I want to show it. I'm not going to take your time to, I feel uncomfortable sometimes because there's no back and forth. So it has to be short, and it has to be, look, I'm happy to talk about this, but I can't find time on our calendars. I think me talking to it, and it's still rough.
You know, Canva has a feature that does that. It lets you record yourself while you're presenting a couple of slides. So, and we use it for lots of stuff. Just letting you know, of course.
That is great to know, because I still just use the free version of Loom that caps you out at 5 minutes. So I use that to like keep it short. Anyway, speaking of keeping it short, we do have to start to wrap up because, you know, that's how we communicate best is by having shows that don't go too long. Anyway, well, one thing we do like to do is talk about something we think might be interesting in our last call. So let's go around the horn and see what we have to share there. Mo, would you like to share your last call first?
Sure. So I read an article recently. It's called I Got Laid Off at Google and It Broke My Heart Because the Company Had Become My Life. Here are three things I learned about defining myself based on my job by Robin Medel. I've actually been sharing it with quite a few women in the tech circles that I'm friendly with because there was a lot in the article that resonates with me. And we've talked about this topic as like a group a lot. Because I suppose for me, it kind of struck a nerve in terms of like, I guess identify as like being good at my job is something that I really care about. And it's really important to me. And even, you know, balancing family and all the other things, it's something that's really stuck. So yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that article and some of the learnings and I guess some of the steps in my own career. But what's really interesting is the other last call that I have is actually a friend of a friend called Yashvi Shah has just set up this new Instagram account and it's called @redirectiontales. And they're sharing stories basically about how rejection have helped people pivot the paths that they wanted to take. And it's like, I read both of these things together in the same week and it kind of made me reflect a lot on, you know, the situation when I got fired, and it's actually ended up being like the best thing that could have possibly happened to my career. But obviously at the time, you know, felt like absolute shit. And I know that with lots of stuff still going on in the tech community, there's probably lots of people that that article also really, really hits home for. So yeah, just been doing all the thinking.
Nice. All right. Tim, what about you? What's your last call?
So it's not going to surprise anyone that it's a podcast recommendation. I came across this by way of Annie Duke, and I am pretty sure we have talked about Katie Milkman before. She's a professor at Wharton, maybe. That's going to be bad if it's incorrect, but she's got the Choiceology podcast with Katie Milkman, and it's interesting because it's actually Charles Schwab sponsored, and I think the tie-in is that when you're managing a portfolio, you're making choices, but they have given her free rein and she has clearly got contact. She's had episodes with like Leon Panetta about the going in for Osama bin Laden and the choices being made. So the format is basically she talks to somebody she actually had an episode with Emily Oster where she has some aspect of making decisions and she talks to one person who's an expert or who has gone on about it. And then she has a second segment that's kind of breaking it down a little bit. So I am not the kind of person who discovers a new podcast and says, I'm going to go back and listen to all the past episodes, but I actually am working my way backwards through the Choiceology with Katie Milkman. They're like 30, 35 minutes long. So compared to us, they're shorter, but really pretty interesting on the kind of decision making. So as we were talking about how it's emotions over data, kind of a well-known thing. That's basically the premise of her entire podcast. What about you, Michael? What's your last call?
Well, interestingly enough, I found this via Christopher Barry, who's a good friend, guest on the show. And it's a INFORMS, which is the Institute for Operational Research and Management Sciences, but it's a paper about team performance. And basically what this paper showed was that team performance, we assume it falls on a normal distribution in terms of how teams actually perform. But what they found in the research was that team performance was not normally distributed at all. And that different teams actually have huge Tales, and the goes into a lot of detail that I am still struggling through, but some of the concepts in there sort of it's what's crazy is I sort of have always believed this anecdotally in my head, and it's sort of like really cool that there's now sort of like real research that's showing like, yeah, this is actually true. And so like, as I've built teams throughout my career, I sort of am like, no, we can build an exceptional team and that actually really, really matters. And it, and actually now it shows like, okay, yeah, actually the data behind this is actually starting to emerge, and it really does. So anyways, I thought that was pretty cool. Cause as you think about sort of putting together teams and things like that, like it is not a normally distributed thing. It's it can actually be very different on the two ends of the distribution. Anyways, very cool. We'll link that in the show notes. All right. Well, as you've been listening, you've probably been thinking, wow, Mo and Tim and Michael, you're such great communicators, but you've forgot about this very salient thing, or have you ever thought about maybe this idea? Well, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to communicate with you, if indeed. So the best way to do that is the Measure Slack group, which it takes a long time to get in, but it's totally worth. If you haven't already signed up for that, join.measure.chat. And the approval process does take a little while, but it will eventually get you in there. And then also on Twitter, we're still on there, and our LinkedIn. So you can reach out to us in all those ways as well. All right. Well, no show would be complete without a huge shout out to our producer, Josh Crowhurst. Thank you, Josh, for all you do, keeping this show on the rails. And thank you, Mo and Tim, for doing this conversation. This was a lot of fun. And I actually learned quite a bit from you two today. So that's been delightful.
Likewise.
And I know I speak for both of you when I say, no matter what your communication skill level, I know that you should keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. Let's keep the conversation going with your comments, suggestions, and questions on Twitter at Analytics Hour, on the web at analyticshour.io, our LinkedIn group, and the Measure Chat Slack group. Music for the podcast by Josh Crowhurst.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
I love Venn diagrams. It's just something about those three circles and the analysis about where there is the intersection, right?
Tim, your prep for this episode is phenomenal. I mean, it always is, but this is particularly good.
I did a lot of prep, but I'm counting on you guys being the talkers.
Oh, as if you're not going to suddenly get really opinionated about something.
I have a couple of really good ones lined up ready for you to take a swing at, Tim. So it's going to be good. All right.
Great.
Here we go. In 5, 4.
Rock flag and empathy.
Always comes back to that.
Always does.
Always.
All right. Okay.